Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
This country was built on a distinctly American work ethic. But today, work is in trouble. We've outsourced most of our manufacturing to other countries. And with that, we sent away good jobs and diminished our capability to make things. American Giant is a clothing company that's pushing back against this tide. They make a variety of high-quality clothing and activewear, like sweatshirts, jeans, dresses, jackets, and so much more. All made right here in the USA, from growing the cotton and adding the final touches. So when you buy American Giant, you create jobs for seamsters, cutters, and factory workers in towns and cities across the United States. And it's about more than an income. Jobs bring pride. Purpose. They stitch people together. If all that sounds good to you, visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order when you use code STAPLE20 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with promo code STAPLE20.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to XYZ, the podcast about CNC, automation, robotics, business, and more. My name is Nick Frank, one of the owners of Frank Brothers Guitar Company, and I'm joined by my co-host, Aaron Goff of Goff Custom Knives. How are you?
Going good, mate. How about you?
Good. Yeah. What's new with you?
Oh, this week's been very productive, actually, the last week since we talked last. Lots of production.
I like to hear that.
Yeah, so I got cranking on machining blades. So I sent out a big batch of blades to DLC, which is fantastic.
Wicked.
They all looked good. I officially launched my custom handle scales last week.
You did?
As well, yeah.
What does an official launch look like?
Well, I just told all my customers about it on an emailing list, right? So
nice.
Yeah, so I've got a whole bunch of those to do now, which should be fun. Yeah, it's been a good week. How about
That's
you?
Super cool. Same. We made some progress with the Haas.
Ooh.
And I've been continuing to think about doing bigger batch of production, which I'm getting more excited about.
Okay.
Just been cruising. Been a pretty decent week.
Nice.
I started biking to work. That Ooh. Feels nice. Dude, I almost hit a raccoon last night.
Oh. Yeah, that'd be bad. You like smash over head first into an angry raccoon. I feel like that would go badly.
Yeah, I knocked. I was driving by a garbage pail and
scared him off.
I scared the apple core out of his mouth or something. He wasn't happy about it.
I've seen you fight. You would lose that fight.
I would lose a fight to a raccoon, 100%. These city raccoons mean business,
right? Nice. So, are you thinking about doing more production batches then?
Yes. So thinking about basically just batching parts. So as opposed to thinking about it necessarily as batching the guitars themselves, what I want to do is create an inventory of machined bodies, like necks with truss rods in them, headstock overlays, tops and backs. I have some of this already done. I've been pulling from it, and it makes production so much smoother. So I just want to take that concept to the next level, so that more what I'm doing is I'm sort of Kanbaning bodies that have been machined and ready to accept tops and backs. So that's what's going to cue production. Otherwise, I'm pulling from inventory to assemble essentially in woodwork custom guitars.
Right. Sounds awesome. Sounds like a good
idea. I'm pretty hyped about it. It's going to be, because we do so much custom, there's so many options. But I think it'll work. Like right now, some of the custom options include like certain binding choices. So binding is the framing around the guitar. So you often see it in white, or we offer tortoise shell,
right?
Multi-ply, which is like white, black, white. But you know, right now I have that stuff already ready to pull from. So the other things would be, you know, is the customer getting a top wood? Is that, or is their top wood maple? Is it Carina? Right. Is it, I don't know.
So you'll have like curly book matched blanks already glued up and ready to go. And then you can laminate them onto a body.
Exactly.
Cut the slots for the binding, chuck the binding in.
Yeah.
Right.
If I have all that stuff prepped, then I should be able to do more assemble, essentially, more guitars in a week.
Right. I think it makes a lot of sense. I personally really like the idea of, yeah, stocking parts internally and then being your own customer.
Like, exactly.
Yeah. And that when you break down a custom offering into all of the components, you know, so for me, if I was to keep every possible handle scale combination ready and pre-laminated, it'd be crazy. I've already got 3,500 combinations. Yeah, like it would be nuts. But if I keep like the scales and the liners separately and everything's set up so that I can just, you know, assemble them, glue them up really quickly on demand, then it becomes much, much simpler. So I think it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, because it's not custom until it's basically been assembled.
Yeah. And you have to always kind of keep your individual, the sheer number of your individual components is always going to be a bit limited because otherwise it just gets nuts. Like you can't offer every possible thing. So.
No. I mean, it's funny. I don't know if you remember this, but when we started the business, like I think maybe 7 years ago, we didn't offer customization at all.
Right.
And we've let that, you know, that pendulum has swung the complete opposite direction.
Right.
I don't think it's going to swing back. I don't know why I'm calling it a pendulum.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of makes sense. Like when you're getting started, you've got enough things to manage besides like giving everyone every option. I think like when you're starting out, doing a very limited range makes sense. But then once you've got that process down, it totally makes sense to let customers choose.
Like that's... Yeah, I mean, and it's easy to not do custom at the beginning when you don't have any customers.
Yeah, because you want to make guitars so that people can be like, I like that, I want one. You know, whereas now everybody knows what the guitars look like and they want to make their own version of it. Yeah, I get it.
Yes.
Yeah, nice.
So then also we actually made some chips in the Haas.
Oh,
not in wood.
Okay. Did you throw any tool holders or break any tools yet?
No.
Nice. Good job, buddy.
Well, we used one tool. So Mark was in on Saturday and Sunday, and I came up in on Sunday, and we put the fixture plate onto the Haas.
So that's Mark, big phenolic sheet, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So Mark had on the axes had cut it to shape and surfaced it on two sides so that we have a level surface.
Right.
And he routed sort of vacuum channels in on the bottom. And then we sandwiched that with a piece of quarter inch phenolic.
Right. Just to capture that, make it airtight.
Exactly. Right. You know, and it's got the, what do you call the gasket material?
Right. Around the outside.
Yeah. Around the actual individual channels, veins, whatever you call them in the.
Right.
But the next step was to countersink the bolts that the bolt heads that are fixing the fixture plate to the Saunders fixture plate.
We
got fixture plate on fixture plate action.
Right.
And so that we did on the Haas, and we're going to surface the whole thing after.
Bolt it down, surface it, make sure it's flat.
Yeah. So to do the countersinks, because the initial holes were drilled on the axes for the bolts, we use the probe to indicate and find where the hole is, the center of the hole, and set that as our G54. So we probed a hole, ran the program to countersink it, probed the next hole, and we did that. I forget how many holes there were, but it was super fun.
It'd be pretty quick using the probe,
It was. I mean, it took less than 5 minutes per hole.
Right. Nice.
And, you know, I was like taking, being careful, making sure I wasn't making any mistakes.
Yeah, sure.
You know.
But which is so good. Fun. It's a good idea.
It ran beautifully.
Nice.
As you'd expect. And now we've got a bunch of countersunk holes. Like, I've never been so excited for a countersunk hole.
Yeah, it's funny when you're getting used to a new tool, you know, like something that would be utterly trivial on a different tool you're like fawning about. You probably went home and you told your wife, like, we made holes for the house.
I know Mark was like, it's so stupid that we're excited about this.
Yeah, but it's a big, fun, dangerous machine. Like, what's not to be excited about?
Exactly. It was a big step making, you know, the first cuts.
Mm-hmm. Nice, man.
And it's great to operate. I mean, you know, I'm getting used to the control, the very limited use that I've done with it. Yeah. Like, just jogging it around is different. Using a jog wheel is different.
Oh, it's so nice, right?
It is nice.
Yeah.
I will say it's kind of like, you know, you have to like, you press the remote jog or handle jog rather, and then you have to select your axes.
Yep.
That you're going to jog. I feel like I've seen this on other machines. I haven't played with other VMCs, but a toggle switch to switch to the axes versus a button.
Oh.
That way, at first glance at the actual control, you know exactly what axes you're selected.
Yeah.
And I think the same with rapids too. You see this with it's a toggle switch.
Like, yes.
That seems to be like, I'm not chirping this thing already, but I feel like that's going to be a mistake I make. I'm in the wrong axes.
Yeah. So the Fidal has a rotary switch for each of those things for feed override and spindle override. It has a rotary switch with no stops. Like, it's just a smooth one.
Oh, cool.
For rapid override and for axis selection and axis increment selection for jogging, those are like rotary switches with like detents.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, and I can use that blind. Like, I can have my head in the machine looking at something with my hand on the pendant, and I'll change between axes and no problems at all.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I really
That's my initial first,
first complaint.
Yes, I wouldn't even call it a complaint. It's just an interesting choice.
I think on the Haas, if you get the remote pendant option, I think that has rotary switches.
Okay.
Cool.
You might be right. I'll have to look at that. I opted to not get that because the machine's so small.
Yeah. I don't think it's a deal breaker, but I agree with you. It is really nice to be able to operate for jogging in particular. It's really nice to be able to operate it without looking at it.
Yeah, without looking at the screen too. Yeah. I mean, it's just more tactile. Or is that the right word?
Yeah, totally. Like, you're just more hands-on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
but it is really cool. Like, coming from the axes, the controller is very limited.
Right. You have to press a button each time you want to jog, right? Like,
yeah, you have to hold a button.
It's brutal.
Yeah, it's a little antiquated.
You can say it. It's shit. It's shit.
It's shit now.
It's shit now. Yeah, having a jog wheel makes a huge difference.
Jog wheel's cool. I didn't know how I would feel about it.
Yeah. I've never used the Haas one, but on the Fidal, it feels like a mechanical mill. Like, it feels like a manual mill. Oh. Like, you're just turning the handle and the machine is just moving.
Got that much resistance?
It's not like super resistance, but the machine just, like, when you turn the handle, the machine moves. It feels very visceral. It feels like those two things are connected.
You know? That's cool. Yeah. I don't know if I would really say the same for this. The other thing it's interesting getting used to is which direction, like, if you're turning it clockwise, it's the table's moving, you know, left.
Right. Well, just to make my life hard, for some reason, my two Fidals are opposite.
No.
Yeah.
What?
I don't know why. But yeah, they're backwards.
No, that's so weird.
I don't know why, you know, like, different software revisions or something, different setup. I could probably fix it. Like, it might just be that the jog wheel's gotten replaced on one of them and it's been wired up backwards.
That would be too funny.
Yeah, I could probably fix it, but honestly, I never even think about it. I just, like, turn it for a second and I see which way it's moving. And, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I haven't put this thing on, I haven't jogged something where it's like so close to the table, except for the probe I just did. But by that, I'm jogging a thou at a time.
Yeah.
So if you could go down a little, it's not going to, not going to crash.
Yeah. I've only broken one probe tip. So.
Oh, that's not bad.
Yeah.
How much is it? It's the Hamer?
Yeah. So I have like the Hamer 3D Taster, which is like a three directional dial indicator. And that thing is,
that's so cool.
Oh, it's so good. But yeah, I mean, they're not, the probe tips aren't that expensive. I think they're like 60, 70 bucks.
Okay, yeah.
And that's for like a steel tip with a, like a ceramic, fusible link. So it's like a ceramic rod that's meant to be fragile. So it fails before you damage the indicator.
Kind of like a dial indicator has like a break point.
Yeah.
On the tip. That's cool. Yeah. One thing that surprised me about the probe is how fast it rams into something to probe it. Like I was like, oh, I'll get used to that. But every time I'm like, oh,
yeah, you think it's going to crash. Right.
Yeah.
It's like, I think you can, itself. Right. I think you can remove it, like turn it down.
I think Mark was saying that he thought that too. I would like to do that. It doesn't seem reasonable. Right. I mean, maybe if you were jogging, if you were like probing a really big bore, you'd want it to move that fast.
Or if you're doing like in process probing where you're like not even watching it, it's just probing. Yeah, I get it. I mean, yeah, it's obviously set up so that it can stop itself fast enough to prevent a crash. So
yeah,
it's fine. But yeah, I get what you mean. It's still like viscerally, you're like, oh shit.
Yeah. And the other thing was we would probe a hole and that sets G54 to zero.
Mm-hmm.
You can see on the control, you could check like position. And a couple times, X was 0.0000 and Y was 0.0001. I was like, what the hell? It's supposed to be zeroing itself, but it wasn't. So now I'm chasing tenths. I feel like a machinist.
Chasing like, tenths when you have no need to.
Yeah. just to do a countersink for a bolt head.
Right.
But I do want to know why that is the
doing. Wait,
that.
So it's supposed to be setting it to zero. Like it should. I wonder whether it is setting it to zero. But then that axis, so like every axis will always drift a little bit off its intended position. So on the Fidal, if you just look at the machine when it's sitting doing nothing, each axis will flicker back and forth around zero. So it'll actually show you like how much error there is in each axis.
If you look at it wrong.
No, just like all the time. Because basically a servo isn't actually capable of sitting still.
Oh, it's like a shark.
Exactly. If it stops, it dies, right? So a servo can't tell where it's sitting unless it's getting feedback from the encoder. So to sit still, what it's actually doing is bouncing back and forth between two encoder positions.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So it's constantly bouncing back and forth. In order to hold still, that's what it's doing. It's always finding the edge to the right and then the edge to the left and bouncing back and forth. So that's why in some servo systems that are like not tuned well, you'll hear like a hum or a buzz.
Yeah. Okay.
Ours
so it does that. Yeah. If you like the axis does that.
Mm-hmm.
If you press like start the program, it like loads it and then it you have to press start again to run it.
Right.
And it's just like,
so I think it's interesting. I said this when you first got that CNC router after I heard it running, you know, and it's a bit surprising because it's an expensive machine, but I'm pretty sure that that machine has stepper motors on it.
Yeah, but I bought the upgrade for servos.
Right. So the difference is, though, a stepper motor can be a servo. So if a stepper motor has an encoder on it, if it has feedback, then it's technically a servo.
Oh, so it's still...
The motor is like still a stepper driver. Yeah, but it's... You know, it's capable of telling when things are going wrong. So I recently bought a whole bunch of closed loop stepper motors and drivers from a Chinese manufacturer. And those are like a compromise between servo performance and stepper performance. And I think that's what's on your CNC router. Because they sound like stepper motors.
I don't know what a stepper motor sounds like.
They have that very distinctive kind of musical sound. Like they're like, boo-dee-dee-boo, you know, when they're... moving different speeds.
Huh.
Whereas a servo is like a true like brushless servo, like on your Haas, is basically silent. Doesn't make any noise.
Yeah, it is very quiet.
Yeah.
Interesting. Well,
yeah. That's, I mean, that's not a bad thing. It's fine. Just open loop steppers, which is what's used on really inexpensive like entry level CNC routers. The main issue with those is if you run into more resistance than the system's designed for, like if a cut's bogging down or something, it'll lose steps. So it'll actually lose its position, but it has no way of knowing that that's happened.
Okay.
So then every part of your program from then on will be offset by like however much it lost, right? So a closed loop stepper will just detect that that's happening. And then the older closed loop steppers, they would just throw an error. They would be like, oh shit, you know, something's wrong. The newer ones, like the ones that I just bought, they actually feed more power into the motor, just like a servo motor would. Which is super cool. So
what are you using those for?
Secret. Yeah. No, I want to build a couple of little, fairly simple CNC routers. Like I'd like to build one
for business or pleasure.
Both, sir. Both. I'd like to build one for just cutting my kydex, right? Because like doing my kydex sheaths, I only need one fixture. I only need one tool. But whenever I need to do that, I have to tie up the VMC.
Right.
You know, like it seems silly to tie up a VMC for something that simple when I could be machining blades, you know. So, yeah, I'd like to do that. We'll see.
Nice. Cool. What's the design going to be? Like just a seriously simple, like extruded aluminum?
No, it won't be that simple. I'll probably use aluminum plate.
Okay.
I found a place local to me that water jets aluminum plate for a really reasonable price. So I might do a lot of it out of like water jet aluminum plate, you know, with proper linear rails and ball screws and the closed loop stepper motors and that kind of stuff. So like, they'd be a pretty serious little machine, but it won't be like a Haas, you know?
Right. Well, that's exciting.
Yeah, it should be fun. We'll see. I've got so many friggin' projects on the go. Mm-hmm. You know,
do you like to put that like pressure on yourself? Buy the stuff. If I buy it, it's happening.
Yeah, and I mean, what I tend to do is like I'll get really interested in a project. I'll go and find the suppliers, you know, for the relevant parts, and then I'll buy. I won't buy all of the parts for the machine. I'll buy a couple here and there just to test them out, see whether those suppliers good. You know, muck around with the parts. And then sometimes they'll end up in that part, sometimes in that system, sometimes they'll end up in being used for something completely different. Sometimes they don't get used at all and they just end up and I use them 2 years later for something else, you know?
Right. Where do you keep all this stuff?
in big blue tubs.
Right.
Yeah. I don't buy that much crazy stuff. I just, sometimes when I think something, you know, could be fun or useful, I'll buy some stuff. I'm not like just, you know, buying servos every day just because, you know. Although I did put a pretty serious hurt on my credit card today.
What'd you buy?
Nothing too crazy. It's just, you know, sometimes when you're like buying materials and stuff, you just have a day where like, I don't know, yesterday and today were kind of like admin days.
Yeah.
And today was like, you know, restocking day. And so I bought close to like $600 worth of materials for the fixturing for the kitchen knives.
Oh, wicked.
That I want to work on, which should be exciting. So
aluminum?
The base is a 1-inch thick water jet cut aluminum plate. So 6061 T6 aluminum plate, 1-inch thick. And the reason I had it water jet was just so, same reason you guys cut your fixture plate on the CNC router rather than on the Haas, so that I can have the actual plate itself be bigger than the machinable area of my CNC.
Right.
And that way I'm not wasting any space for like hold down bolts and stuff, you know? So yeah, I mean, just that plate by itself is pretty pricey. It's like $250 worth of aluminum.
Wow.
And then there'll be like individual replaceable stations on the top of that made of steel. Each one will be pinned using dowel pins. So it can be taken off and replaced in the same position if need be, or it can be taken off and remachined and a new one put in place if need be.
Okay. So it's not going to be like a pallet system. It's going to be single purpose.
Yeah. It is kind of a pallet system, because I actually have holes bored in the table of my CNC machines.
Right. Did you get a lot of slack for that?
A couple of people were like, oh my God, why would you do that? But like, who cares? It's a 25-year-old CNC machine. You know, like, I'm going to use them. I mean, like, if somebody else, if I decide to sell them down the road and somebody else is like, oh, I'll take $3,000 off for those holes, I'd be like, no, man, like, they're in the right place. They're nice bored holes. Like, who cares, you know? So, yeah, I mean, that means I can just locate the fixtures on there. So the fixtures that I make have dowel pins in the bottom, protruding in the same pattern as the holes in the table. I just chuck them in. And then when I'm not using the holes, I actually put dowel pins in the holes. But I use dowel pins, what they call pull dowel pins. So the dowel pins have like a threaded hole in one end.
Okay.
Which means I can just yank them out. Like I can guarantee that I can get them back out, you know, even though they're flush.
Okay. That's smart. Yeah. I bought some of those a while ago thinking that they would be good for the dowel pins that we use for our bodies that we've now used phenolic dowel pins.
Right.
They're nice. Yeah.
Yeah. They're a bit pricey, but like who cares? Mm-hmm. Like I'm only buying like 10 of them ever. You know,
yeah. So. I think that was my issue.
Yeah, if you're going to be using them every time in like a consumable fashion, then yeah.
Yeah, they were still hard to pull out for as often as we were pulling them out.
Right.
Pretty frequently.
Yeah, and I mean, so if you do decide to revisit that, usually they're hard to pull out because there's a vacuum. So if you grind a flat down one side of the dowel pin, usually that lets enough air in underneath that they're a lot easier to get out.
Nice. Yeah, I think we're going to switch over to just using pins and bushings.
Right.
Like the ones we bought from McMaster Car for the fixture blades.
The
pallet system.
Fixturing pins and the diamond pins and so on. Yeah.
And I think we're going to actually embed the bushing into the body of the guitar. And that'll live with it until it's
finished.
Cut out. Right. And then we can just retrieve them.
I'm
going to put a access cutout on either side of the bushing so we can pry it out with a flat drive screwdriver.
Hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Cool idea, man.
I think it'll be nice. It'll be, you know, it'll be a slip fit versus like the compression fit we're doing right now. So it'll make things just
great,
a little easier.
And you're going to have vacuum to hold them down, whereas currently you're kind of counting on the pins to hold them down a little bit, right?
Yes. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's for the bodies. We're bolting the bodies down.
Oh, that's fine. Nice, man. Sounds good.
Yeah.
The other thing that I bought today that I'm very excited about is, so I have to give a shout out to MW Blades on Instagram. So I've been using mold polishing stones for a really long time to do the finishing on my blades. So they're kind of like a little sharpening stone, but they're made, you can buy them in like lots of different, grades. So they have different abrasives. So the ones I use are all silicon carbide. And then the bond that holds the abrasive grains together is different. So you can buy like hard bonds, medium bonds, soft bonds.
Okay.
And, so it's imagine like having sandpaper that like self sharpens.
Right.
Right.
Like a grinding wheel.
Yeah, kind of. They get worn away as you're using them. And the fact that they wear away exposes fresh abrasive, which means they keep cutting, you know?
Right.
Cause like, you know, sandpaper on wood, really you throw it out when it clogs.
Yes.
Like, whereas sandpaper on metal, particularly hardened steel, you actually like dull the abrasive grains.
Right.
That so yeah. And I've been using mold polishing stones for a really long time. I'm going to do a video on them soon because I think they're kind of like a secret, you know, like so many people don't use them. It's crazy to me. They cut your hand finishing time on hardened steel in half.
Mold polishing stones.
Yeah. Yeah. So the reason they're called mold polishing stones is because they're originally designed for polishing plastic injection molds.
Ah, I gotcha.
Yeah. So you would like back in the day, to do really complicated molds, they would rough them when the materials, when the steel is soft, then they would send them out for heat treat. Then they would bring them back and start finish machining them. Sorry, if you can hear in the background, my dog is going crazy right now. She's just attacking her blanket.
I can't hear.
They would do the like finishing cuts, and then they would use a sinker EDM, an electric discharge machining machine to cut some more of the features. And then they'd have to have a guy, like they'd be doing bench work. So they'd have a guy by hand polishing an injection mold that might be like, you know, several square feet worth of hardened steel. And these
by hand.
Yeah, by hand. And you might have to polish them to like a mirror finish.
Holy.
And be out of that industry, so mold polishing stones were developed for that. And then, you know, they have like really fancy pencil die grinders, like air-driven die grinders.
Right.
For like polishing and shaping stuff. And they also made these reciprocating lapping machines. So it's an air-powered machine that actually holds one of the EDM stones and then will reciprocate the stone like a little, kind of like an inline sander. And it'll actually push the stone back and forth like 18,000 times a minute.
Wow. What's it called?
They're called air lappers or like a pneumatic file. So yeah, MW Blades on Instagram posted a video of using an air lapper with the stones. And I'd looked at them a bunch of times back in the day and I'd always been like, oh, they're too expensive. But I have no idea why I was thinking that because they're like... buying like a really good one from a reputable company is like $300 US.
Yeah. Wow.
You know, like not that expensive. You know, so it's kind of funny, like on the show we talk about like automation and like, I don't know, it's really easy to think of automation as like, you know, robots and all this crazy shit. But like this little machine is going to let me automate like moving my hands back and forth.
Right.
You know, like
it's a hand tool, but an efficient one.
Yeah, so I'm really looking forward to that because my body's been, my arms, my right elbow in particular, has been giving me trouble when I'm hand finishing lots of blades. So.
Yeah, well, that's super exciting. I mean, it's going to be only a matter of time before you want to build a robot to hold this device.
Right, and move it around. Yeah, I mean, you totally could, right? So maybe.
So does this DW Blades, does he have a video of himself doing this?
Yes, he posted it on his Instagram. So it's MW Blades.
Oh, MW, my bad.
Yeah. And yeah, so he actually bought a really inexpensive one off Amazon. He sent me the link to it. It was like $50. I was like, holy crap. And I looked at a few of them and the only problem I could see was that they didn't seem to list the stroke length. And that's kind of a vital, like parameter for these machines. Cause you can get them in all sorts of different stroke lengths from like 0.1 millimeters all the way up to like 3 millimeters of stroke.
Okay.
And the stroke length that you want depends on like what grit of stones you're using and, you know, how big of an area you're finishing.
Right.
So if you're like polishing an injection mold and you have to polish like little tiny slots or something, you might want the 0.1 millimeter stroke length because otherwise you're going to be hitting the edge or the side of the slots, you know?
Right.
Whereas for a knife, you're kind of finishing a larger flat surface. So I went with a 1.2 millimeter stroke length. So, yeah, hopefully that should be arriving next week. I'm super excited to try that out.
Wow. Will you post a video of that?
Oh, 100%. Oh, I'm actually going to post a whole video on, like, how to use mold polishing stones because there's only one or two other videos out there showing them.
So, I, on your, I think, suggestion years ago, bought a Lansky sharpening kit.
Mm-hmm.
That is not a mold polishing stone.
Actually, they might be using mold polishing stones as the sharpening thing for the Lansky. Like, that might be where they're getting their stones from.
Oh, okay. So this, they just put it on a piece of plastic.
Yeah, basically. And, like, it could, I don't know what kind of grade they're using. They're probably using, like, a hard bond aluminum oxide stone, right? Because, you know, like, the stones that I use, if you use them in a sharpening system, they would wear way too quickly.
Okay.
But the faster the stones wear, the faster they cut.
Oh, interesting.
Right. So, cause they're always exposing that. That means they are exposing fresh abrasive more quickly.
But do you have to lap them flat?
No. So basically you have to just develop a technique. If you were polishing an injection mold, then yeah, you might have to shape the stones, right? You might have to keep reshaping them so that you don't distort the feature that you're, polishing. But when you're sanding a knife, you just kind of develop a technique to move the pressure around to keep the stone in a shape that is useful.
So like you're even wear.
Yeah. So basically I hold it at like, I hold it kind of like if you were, kind of like an eraser, like not like a pencil, not like that, like 45 degrees, more like quite an almost like a chisel.
Okay.
A chisel is a better analogy, actually.
You're talking my language.
Yeah. So, you know, at a relatively shallow angle relative to the blade. And then I'm kind of using one hand to apply pressure. So I've got two fingers on the back of the stone applying pressure downwards. And I'm using the other hand to move it around, if that makes sense.
Uh-huh.
And as I wear a flat, you know, so you'll be wearing a flat on the stone. And then the end of the stone, the tip of the stone, will start getting really thin. And as soon as it starts getting thin, then I use the tip, that thin tip of the stone, to get into the plunge line of the blade.
Right.
And that kind of blunts the tip of the stone again. And then I go back and do the bevel. So I kind of switch back and forth.
Where's this fast?
Yeah. I mean, one stone probably lasts for like 10 blades.
Oh, wow. Okay. Crazy.
Yeah. And like it literally, like you can see material coming off the stone and forming a slurry on the blade as you're using it.
Cool.
They're amazing. They are amazing. Like they, from compared to sandpaper, I would say they cut your finishing time in half, and they probably cut your materials cost in half as well.
Right. Sandpaper is wildly expensive.
Yeah. I would say, like, you know, on one knife, you're probably using two sheets of sandpaper, and, you know, like that's like $2. It's not a lot. But one mold polishing stone is like $4, and then it lasts for 10 knives.
Oh yeah.
So, you know, like
that's good.
That's a big difference over time.
Yeah, like a sheet of sandpaper can be $1. Doesn't that seem expensive?
No, yes. If I had to make it, that'd be like $5 each.
Sure.
But yeah,
I mean, we're getting
this
like Finnish. It's the funniest thing because they're made in Finland and it's for Finnish.
Right.
Nobody else thinks that's funny, I guess.
I get it. Sorry,
yeah.
I'm slow.
Thank you.
Is that Saya Watt or whatever it's
Merca.
Called? Merca. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
They use that a lot in like auto body shops and stuff, right?
I guess so, yeah. I don't know. I mean, we just really like it. We experimented with a couple different ones, and we've been using this stuff for probably 5 years now.
Right.
Nice. So I haven't thought too much about it. But yeah, I think you're right. I think it's... The place we get it from definitely is supplying auto industry.
Right. Because I know they sell those like the mesh sandpaper that like has like a... Yeah, yeah.
That stuff's great. Yeah. That stuff's great when you get sick of aligning the holes in a like a disc sandpaper with the holes in your sander, your orbital.
Yeah.
Which you wouldn't think would be that annoying, but it's really annoying. And I'm like, I want them to be perfectly aligned.
Right.
And they never are.
Right. I saw something the other day that like it made me want it, even though I don't really have a use for it, I think, which was it's a tiny air-powered orbital sander.
Like how tiny?
Like the discs are like 1 inch in diameter.
Yeah, that's nice.
It just looked really cute.
We have a 3-inch, which feels pretty small. We never use it. We use a 5-inch.
Well, I was looking at it. And I was like, I wonder whether I could use like an orbital sander to do blades.
Yeah, I wonder.
I do want to experiment at some point. So like, you know, as I said, the mold polishing guys, you know, they will do like an injection mold to a mirror finish. Like, for like an optical mold or even for just something random like an Xbox controller, you know, like on the Xbox controller, there's like a matte plastic on the top. And then the bottom is like a glossy plastic. And to make that glossy plastic, they have to mirror polish the mold.
Right.
Right. Like it's nuts. But the way they do that is with, like a diamond lapping paste on like felt bobs on a die grinder.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. I mean, that's how we polish our guitars to a high gloss is with, liquid compounds.
Right.
And a foam pad.
Right. Yeah, I kind of want to do that on a knife.
Oh, man, that'd be so cool.
I kind of want to do it.
I want a high gloss knife.
One day.
It's an interesting topic. I mean, I feel like there's people who've dedicated their entire lives to polishing or in sanding.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a whole subsection of manufacturing.
Well, it's kind of interesting too, because like as I said, like I've learned a lot from mold polishing guys, right? But nowadays, if you go in like a machinist forum and you ask like a mold polishing question, and I actually did this the other day, I was like, what stroke length do I choose for this pneumatic lapper? You know, I have no idea. And no one could really answer me because mold polishing is kind of a dying art.
Oh, interesting.
Right? Like in China, lots of injection molds still get hand finished. But in the US, in order to compete against inexpensive injection molds, like US companies seem to have mostly gone to hard milling. So they'll you know, buy incredibly high-end machines like a Makino F5, which is capable of producing like a mirror finish right out of the CNC machine.
Well, I mean, that makes a lot of sense. That's pretty sick.
Yeah. And then they just run it unattended, you know, for like 3 or 4 days straight. And then you end up with like a finished mold. I mean, obviously it's a lot harder than that, but, but you know, like they're literally exchanging that like manual labor, which is really expensive, in a developed country for machine time.
Right. Also, aren't there a lot of like molds etched to have like a pattern, like a texture?
Yes, I believe that. I don't know if it's to avoid that, but it'd be for like wear purposes, right? Oh. So like the Kydex that I buy for my injection molds is finished with a texture called hair cell. And the reason that they do that is so that it doesn't show wear.
Okay, that makes sense.
Right. And yeah, I believe those are still like photo etched or laser etched.
Yeah, cool.
They don't really machine them.
There's somebody I follow on Instagram. I should, before I even say this, find out who, but they do molds.
Oh, and they do the texturing?
They do the texturing.
Please send me a link to that. Yeah, please send me a link to that. I'd be really curious. So I've actually tried a couple of times now to do texturing in CAD to 3D print parts that have a texture already on them. And that process is utterly, utterly brutal. Like, I have crashed Fusion 360 multiple times and made it completely unusable. I've actually made it so you cannot open a drawing.
Is it just so because it's the complexity of...
Yeah, yeah.
Like, overlaying a pattern?
Yeah, so, like, making... So, basically, the way you would do it is you'd make, like, a 2D sketch, and then you would, like, project that pattern onto your 3D part and kind of, like, emboss it into the part.
Right.
The problem is that Fusion really doesn't like it when you put, like, 10,000 elements in a sketch. It just seems to bring it to its knees trying to compute all of that.
Right.
Yeah, and like as I said, I've literally made drawings that like crashed Fusion, and then I like couldn't open them again because when you try and open them, Fusion's like trying to do that thing that crashed it. You know?
Right. So it's just forever lost.
No, it was fine. I just like reverted to an older version, and then it was, you know, back again. But like, yeah, it's an interesting problem.
That's cool.
Mm-hmm.
Molds are crazy.
They are.
Something you wouldn't think is so complicated.
Yeah, I guess so. You just never think about it.
Yeah. I mean, all the plastic parts, you're like, well, they make this out of like some better material. But like
yeah.
The thought that went into making that.
The thing that boggles my mind is like going to the dollar store. I mean, if you're going to go to the dollar store and buy a dollar store toothbrush, which I don't know if I'd recommend that. But let's say you do. And that toothbrush has like glossy surfaces on it. You know,
right.
Like the mold that made that toothbrush is probably worth like 50 grand,
right?
You know, 100 grand.
Yeah, so we had we have like these nameplates that go on to that we affix to our cases, the guitar right. cases, and we had them made locally.
Okay.
And they are the shape of our logo, which is hexagon, and to make that shape in sheet in the metal, it's like it's brushed aluminum. They quoted us to have a mold made, and it was something like $5,000 or $6,000.
Oh, to have like a die to cut to them
have,
out of
have
the
have a die, maybe yeah. Right. So it's not a plastic mold, different thing, right. I suppose. But
yeah, but still, it's yeah.
It was so expensive. They ended up actually laser cutting them.
That makes total sense for your quantity, yeah.
But they were like just got their laser cutter, so they had some problems with alignment, with aligning it with the because it's chemically etched.
Right.
Our logo is chemically etched into it and then laser cut, so that there was like the alignment with the border of our logo with the actual cutout of the shape.
Well,
problematic, but
we might have talked about this last week on the show, but there's a company in the States called Send Cut Send. maybe you and I talked about this after the show, actually. Yeah. So there's a company in the States called SendCut Send, and they do on-demand laser cutting. So you can just upload like a DXF file onto their website, and then they just tell you how much it is. And then you get quantity breaks and so on. But they actually do etching as well, like laser etching. So you could have them laser etch and then cut the parts all in one operation straight from the sheet.
Yeah, I should get a quote for that.
Yeah. Yeah, it sounds like it'd be super straightforward.
Something nice about having it made by this local company that we've been buying them off of for like the past 7 years, but you know.
Well, yeah, the problem I have is that, like, you know, so I'm getting these fixture plates water jet cut, right? And honestly, like, the company I'm dealing with now, they're pretty good. Like, I email them, an hour later I get a quote back and I say yay or nay, and then they, you know, call me for the credit card details. But sometimes when you're like prototyping something, you know, for laser cutting, if you have like a bunch of little holes, let's say you have like, you know, a 12-inch square part, so like a 1-square-foot part with like 100 holes in it, that's going to cost like, you know, $50. Whereas like just as a one square foot rectangle might be like $4. You know, like, it's really nice to just be able to get an idea of pricing just by like chucking a bunch of files into an automatic quoting system.
You know,
you
don't feel like it's fully automatic.
Fully automatic.
How fast are you getting a quote back?
Instantaneously.
Wow. Oh, that's cool.
Like, you just upload your part and it just tells you, yeah, this part will be $12 for one, or like $6 each for 10, you know, or $3 each for 1,000.
Like, as a programmer, instant. Does that impress you?
A computer not programmer? Really. it's not actually a super complicated problem. What really impresses me is that people have been so slow to implement this. Like,
that seems complicated, because it seems like there's a lot of elements, factors.
I guess so, but like, you know, you just program it once and then it works like for free forever. You know, like, why would you pay someone to manually quote these parts, you know, on an ongoing basis? Like, maybe you have to have like 3 people just in customer service quoting these parts all day long. You know?
Well, no, if you can, it's great. I just figured like it'd be difficult with the, you know, it's like, what material are you using? Can you like make these selections? Are you giving
100%.
Okay, so it's like some drop downs that.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, so you choose like a drop down. You choose what material you want, what thickness you want, what finish on the material.
Right.
You know, do you want deburring? You know, upload your part and then it tells you how many and off you go.
Okay. For some reason, I was picturing something more complicated, but that makes sense. Not. You're entering a lot of the information yourself.
Yeah. And so, like, just, it kind of boggles my mind. I guess that, you know, people come from industries that aren't used to thinking about things that way, about, you know, automating the solution. And so the answer, the default answer is just to throw people at it.
Right.
Right. Like, you get a new person, you tell them, you know, when it looks like this, it costs this much. And then, you know, you just throw people at it. But I guess, so the first company I know of that did this was a company in the States called Osh Cut. And they, as far as I know, are an extension of another company called Osh Park. And they were basically doing short run circuit boards. So they had a US manufacturing facility, and you could like upload your circuit board design. And to make producing like, you know, 1 or 3 circuit boards feasible, they would batch your circuit boards with a whole bunch of other people's circuit boards and then send that like combined file to a fab to have your circuit board cut.
Right.
But like, until they started doing it, like, you couldn't get like 3 circuit boards. You had to order like 100, 500, you know?
Right.
And then they basically took that same kind of system and started doing it with laser cutting as well. And it totally makes sense, you know? So I think they approached it differently because they were like electronic engineers and software nerds.
Right.
Like me.
Well, it is, I mean, these days too, we're just like, people are just used to a certain like
timeliness.
Yeah.
Instant gratification.
And it has to be easy too. Like, I mean, I was thinking, this is kind of making me think of when we were deciding what tooling to buy for the Haas, like tool holders. And we ended up going with Meritool based on your recommendation. And you can just go and click what you're buying on their website.
Yes. Whereas there's so many other people in the tooling industry, you have to like look through catalogs and there's part numbers and, you know, you
have Kennametal was our other one of the other options, and we were going to get like a credit through Haas.
Yeah, so Haas do like a tooling credit bundled with the machine, right?
Yeah. But I mean, Maritool's prices were still competitive with the discounted pricing on the Kennametal stuff, which is just more expensive, probably because they've got dealers or that have a markup on it and blah blah blah, who knows. But it was just like going through their website, it was so confusing. Like they're using different names for the type of tooling, like for Cat 40 they had like, it was just hard to find even a Cat 40 tool holder.
Yeah, it does drive me a bit crazy when, you know, and I know that I've been guilty of, like, sometimes it's hard when you're looking at your own system, you're like, yeah, that makes sense, because you've been indoctrinated into a certain system. But yeah, like Maritool's system is just, it's so nice to just be able to like look at a tool holder, see a photo of it. They've got like PDFs and like CAD files of the tool holders. So I don't know whether you found this yet, but they actually have a tool library that you can import into Fusion 360, and then it gives you 3D models of every tool holder.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah, and then you can just say, okay, I've got this tool in this tool holder, and then Fusion will simulate like the tool holder and everything when you're running simulations.
Oh, wicked. I like that.
Yeah, super nice.
Yeah, because we are using all the same tool holders right now, but I would like to get some like ER20 tool holders for like
with skinny noses or something.
Yeah, so that would be cool to see, you know, the different tool holders represented in the CAM file.
Yeah, 100%. I do the exact same thing. In fact, I actually like, so for the kitchen knife fixtures, I downloaded their tool library. I had a look through and I picked one out that looked right. And then I simulated it with that tool holder and that tool. I don't even own the tool or the tool holder yet. Like, I'm going to buy the tool and the tool holder to suit the fixtures and the programs that I'm designing, you know?
Yeah. That super is nice. Cool. Oh, so that reminds me, I've been looking at shell mills.
Oh.
Because we surface our bodies, mahogany bodies, and they are 15 inches by 18 inches. Mm-hmm. And we're surfacing them right now with a half inch bit.
Right. So it's going to take a little bit.
Yeah. So I'm interested. The biggest tool we can hold diameter wise in the side mount tool changer without taking up a pocket on either
three
side.
Three pockets. Yeah.
Yeah. Is 2.5 inches, which that would mean, you know, we're going to surface a body 2 times faster.
Right.
2.5 times faster?
5 times faster.
Probably. 5 times faster.
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
Remind me never to do math on a public podcast. So I'm looking at, they've got a 45 degree shell mill. That looks nice. And some...
The SEHT inserts. Is that the one?
The Corloy ones?
Well, yeah, so they'll have like a designation. So I think the ones that you're looking at are SAHT. So they're square inserts with the 45 degree.
Yeah. SHIT, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Real mature. So I'm just jumping on the website now. 2.5 inch diameter. It should be, right? SHW?
SEHT.
And then
the ones I'm looking at are the Corloy.
The aluminum specific ones, right? The really the sharp, shiny ones?
The sharp, shiny ones.
Yes, yeah. So those are SAHT. Yeah, so that would be exactly what I'd recommend.
Yeah, sweet. Okay, good to know. I'm pretty excited about that as an option.
Yeah. I can imagine. I'm actually, I've been looking at that same tool for a while. I haven't quite justified it. We just share it, send it back and forth. I haven't quite justified it yet. I don't know how those inserts are going to deal with hardened steel. That's one thing that I'm a little curious about.
Is there an insert that would work better for that?
Yes. So that shape of insert, so the SEH shape, they have a bunch of different like geometries. So you can get ones with like, they have like rounded over corners. So it produces like a negative rake tool, which is very tough. Yeah, I'm sure there'll be something. I have to try it.
Right. Yeah, it's a bit of a barrier to entry with the price. So it's like $126.55
just
USD
for
the shell mill.
Yeah, and then you need a holder.
The holder, I think, is $115 as well, and then 5 inserts.
Yes.
So the total for the tool is going to come out to like $300.
Yeah, so the benefit of buying a more expensive shell mill like that is the pockets need to be positioned really precisely with regards to each other to make sure that you get a nice surface finish.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Because if the pockets are all like high or low relative to another, then each insert will cut high or low and you'll end up with a streaky, shitty finish.
Right.
That may not matter so much in wood because it's really hard to see whether like one insert is like one thou high, you know, whereas in like hardened steel, it'd be really, really obvious.
Right. But tool wear as well would be a consideration. Like if one tool is
doing most of the work.
Yeah. Then.
Yeah. I don't think it's going to be a big deal in wood or in phenolic. But yeah, in steel, it definitely is more of a big deal.
We get it. Steel's harder to cut.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe just make wood knives then.
I'm just making sure. I'm putting you in your place, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, there are cheaper options, right? Like I'm not going to mention them. I don't, you know, necessarily condone some of the cheaper options, particularly for shell mills, because I kind of worry about them like coming apart.
Ooh.
You know, I did see,
not ideal, so, it'd be like a bullet,
right? So in the automotive industry they use shell mills sometimes that are up to like 12 inches in diameter.
Oh cool.
These are terrifying things. So imagine a 12 inch diameter shell mill with like potentially only one cutting insert. So it's kind it's of like called a fly cutter. Yeah.
Fly cutter, yeah.
On like a Cat 40 tool holder. So like the tool holder itself is like 2 inches in diameter and then it's got like a 12 inch bar sticking out of it. And they use these for facing cylinder heads. So like parts of engines that have to be really flat to mate together. Mm-hmm. But I did see a video of what happens when one of those comes apart. Oh, so they had this thing spun up to like 7,000 RPM or something stupid. And
wow, 7,000 RPM at the spindle?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, how fast is the tool moving?
Oh, God knows. Like, but it went through the machine enclosure, went through a concrete block, and then came out in another room. Yeah.
Wow, that's wicked.
And the video,
can you post
was like,
that video in the show notes?
I'll have to see. They showed the tool holder like embedded in a wall in the other room.
And did like that was the operator standing there and the top half of his body just slips.
Yeah. Right. Like one of those. Yeah. Like in one of those vampire movies. Exactly.
That's cool.
Right.
Well, so the 2.5 inch shell mill seems a little less scary, but okay. If you think about a jointer, like ours have straight blades, but you can get a jointer for surfacing a piece of wood. That's like 20 inches wide that has 70, 80, 100, I don't know, inserts in them.
Right.
It's basically like a massive shell mill.
Yeah. Like they call that like a corn cob mill, corn cob insert mill. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Sounds terrifying.
Yeah. We used to have one in a combination planer jointer. It was nice.
Spinning at like 3,000 RPM.
Yeah, and it was silent.
Ooh. Before we go, look, Nick, you and I, we could shoot the shit for forever, and we have. But before we go, we should answer some questions. Don't you think?
Deal.
Don't you think? Mm-hmm. All right.
They're all going to be for you about knives.
No, they're not, actually. They're not. Oh. One thing, so we have, before we have any questions, we have a couple of suggestions. So Wing and Wave Designs on Instagram sent me a post which is hilarious. I don't know if we talked about this last week, actually. The Fingerbot Plus. It's just like a little robot that just presses a button.
Okay.
It's hilarious. So he suggested that for turning off my compressor.
Nice.
That I could just attach that. I did actually find a really nice solution for turning off my compressor. I bought all the parts today. I'm actually going to be able to integrate it into the compressor package. Like, it's going to be fully built in. So in the front of the compressor, there's all of the control circuitry is built on this stuff called DIN rail, which is like a steel rail, like 1.5 inches tall, that like relays and stuff all snap onto.
Yeah.
And there's some blank areas in there where I could put more stuff. And I actually found that you can buy programmable timers that are DIN rail mountable. So you can say every day at 11 p.m., even accounting for daylight savings time,
fancy.
Turn this relay on and off for 1 second. And then that little relay will just be connected to 110 volts AC and to a solenoid, like a magnetic pushy thing. And the solenoid will be on the outside of the machine and it'll just press its own off button.
Wow. So simple.
Yeah, it's going to be super simple. The only problem is if you want like a really nice, like UL CSA certified DIN rail mounted timer, they're like $100.
From McMaster?
From DigiKey.
Okay.
The ones from McMaster were like $250.
But it's McMaster.
Yeah, I know. So yeah, the solution's going to be really nice, but Wing and Wave design designs, I really do appreciate that. He said he was laughing when he found it on Kickstarter. He was like, he listened to the podcast the day before and then found that on Kickstarter the day after.
Good find.
Yeah.
We should all get finger bots.
Right?
Just find something to do with them.
And j.berry_knives on Instagram made a suggestion for a $1,200 CNC router.
Oh, great.
Because we were talking about that a couple of weeks ago for Baltic Blades. So there's a company called Millwright, which is spelled M-I-L-L-R-I-G-H-T. And they have a machine called the Carve King. And that looks a lot kind of like the Shapeoko, same kind of form factor, but it has lead screws on all axes rather than the belts.
Nice.
And it comes with a router for the spindle.
Oh, yeah.
As like part of the package. Yeah, and it's $1,200. It looks pretty decent.
Nice. And it's the king of mills.
The king of carving.
Yeah, king of carving, right.
There you go. So yeah, that might be an option for Baltic Blades for $1,200-ish CNC router.
Score.
So
they got some other more expensive options too.
Yes, they have like bigger ones. That one's like 17 inches by 17, and then they have bigger ones that are more expensive.
And more like robust ones on top.
Oh, they do too.
Okay. Cool.
I didn't have a super thorough look through the website, I will admit.
Excellent suggestion.
Yes, exactly. And then we have a question for you, actually, Nick. So Real Penny Pincher on Instagram asked, are there any tour videos of your shop and your CNC gear?
You know, we've been meaning to do a proper shop tour. So my apologies. We don't have that. But what we do have is like we shot a video with Blundstone, the boot company. And they did like, I haven't watched it in a while, but they did like a little walkthrough of our shop, or we did a little walkthrough of our shop. So you can check that on our website, frankbrothersguitars.com or frankbgc.com. And if you want to see more stuff from our shop, though, we do post videos on our Instagram, which is @frank_brothers. And we'll often post stories of random stuff, including like the CNC running and whatever else we're up to.
Do you guys have a YouTube channel? Check it out.
We do. We don't have a ton on there. We do have, and there's a lot of like demo videos. So not a lot, but there's some demo videos of the guitars being played. So, but
do you want to do more like
I do? Yeah,
shop stuff.
Like, yeah. I want to become a YouTube celeb like you.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'd be down to like help you guys shoot some stuff if you wanted to.
Yeah, that'd be fun. I'm gonna look myself up on
YouTube.
We have 15 videos.
Oh, nice.
That's I think the majority of them are the guitar being played, but there is one called Making a Bowtie Headstock. That's what we call our headstock design,
right?
Sort of shaped like a bowtie. And you can see part of the process on the CNC and how we inlay our binding. Cool. So yeah, you can check that out.
Nice. Sweet.
bump the views up.
Bump them up. Thousands, my, tens my, of thousands. I'm coming.
My dream of becoming a YouTube, a professional YouTuber come true.
Hotter than you'd think.
God damn. I imagine.
Yeah. And then Scott Hoadley on Instagram, he asked two questions, but I'm going to get to the first one because it's actually very on topic. He said, any recommendations for learning Fusion 360? And this is actually funny because I actually recorded the first in a tutorial series over the weekend.
Hmm.
So I'm going to be releasing that soon. So the very first one is going to be just a very basic intro, like Fusion 101, you know,
right?
And then the next one I'm going to be doing is a knife, like making a knife start to finish in Fusion. And that'll be a bit more advanced because you're doing like sweeps and components and all sorts of interesting stuff.
Right.
And then I'm also going to do, CAM in Fusion 360. So like, tools and toolpaths and all that kind of stuff. So it sounds like that might be good for Scott Hoadley. And it also sounds, I'm guessing, Nick, that you are getting into Fusion at the
moment. Yeah, I'll be watching those for sure.
Sweet. So yeah, I think they'll be going on my YouTube channel within the next couple of weeks.
How exciting.
Yeah.
Learn from the master.
Well, I don't know about that. I even say in the video, like, Fusion is a huge program these days. Like,
right.
There's, yeah. Like, they have a sheet metal workspace in Fusion specifically just for doing sheet metal, and then you can actually use that for designing like cardboard boxes that'll like fold up and snap together and stuff too, right?
That's
like,
wicked. Yeah,
yeah, it's crazy how deep that program is these days.
Yeah, awesome. When, like, what's the history behind Fusion 360?
I think Autodesk made it as like kind of like a modernized or simpler version of Inventor, which is one of their kind of industrial design 3D products.
Okay.
And then like Autodesk were originally famous for doing architectural software.
Mm-hmm.
So then I think Inventor was their kind of like entry into the industrial design space. And then Fusion is kind of like, I don't know. I think it was originally designed as like the more accessible kind of entry level thing, but then it's, I think it's kind of taken off, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it seems to be sort of becoming a favorite.
Yeah, and I think a big part of that is just that, like, so SolidWorks was originally the favorite, and like SolidWorks and Fusion in a lot of ways, when Fusion started in particular, were very similar, but there was no like really easy way to get into SolidWorks unless you had like an educational license, and then you couldn't use it for commercial stuff,
right?
Whereas Fusion, when it started, they had like, they do still have some very attractive licenses for people that are just getting started with it. Like, if you're doing non-commercial stuff, you can have like a hobby license.
Mm-hmm.
And that lets you do most things. And then they have a startup license that is free if you're doing a startup business for the first year.
Right. That's, I think I have that, had that, or
yeah,
probably expired now, but
I had that too. And then they changed the, originally you could have it for as long as you wanted, as long as you made under like 160 grand a year or 250K or something in the business. And then they changed it so that it's only free for the first year. Mm-hmm. So like I pay like $750 Canadian a year for Fusion.
Not bad. I mean, it's pretty powerful software.
Yeah. And I mean, I still kind of grimace every time I pay that. But if I was to use anything else, like OneShape or, sorry, OnShape or SolidWorks or whatever, they'd all be like double or triple that,
right?
At the minimum, you know. So, cool. Yeah, for what you get, I think Fusion's a good deal.
So we're all going to learn Fusion, or me and Scott are going to learn Fusion from.
Yeah, I mean, it really isn't too bad. Like, I'm trying to keep it really basic. Like, you don't have to learn every tiny nook and cranny to just start making shit.
Yeah. So there are also, some great YouTube tutorials though on,
yes,
that I've done them, where you make a specific object in,
yep,
you know, with somebody essentially, like you follow, yeah, along like Bob Ross, and, those are a really cool way to learn just some of the basic things.
Yeah. And that's exactly how I'm structuring
how to
my
extrude
videos as well.
Something and,
yep,
whatever, chamfer or something.
Yeah,
you make like a Lego block. Really cool.
It's funny that you said that because that's exactly what I'm doing in the first video. Oh, nice. I don't know whether there are other tutorials doing that, but that's exactly what I'm doing in the first video.
Nice. I mean, it's a great shape for that because it's extruded. It's sort of like a thin wall. It's good shape. I don't know why, but
So one of the things I did with my tutorial is I made sure that you're doing everything in a parametric fashion. So the last thing we do after making the Lego block is actually go through and change it until it doesn't look like a Lego block at all, just by changing dimensions.
Oh, cool.
And then the whole drawing restructures itself. Everything, you know, is still correct in relation to each other, but you change like the height, you change the number of little nubs on the top.
Oh, wicked.
The size of the nubs, you know, all of that kind of stuff. Everything's parametric.
That's really cool.
And it's very, very simple. Like that doesn't add any complexity to the design.
Will you do the cam for that object?
I will do the cam for an object. I'm not sure if it will be the Lego block, but yes, whatever I do, like if I do a cam tutorial for a different object, then I will
include the
drawing. Yeah. Well, we probably won't do the CAD, but I'll like, you know, upload the CAD file so you can just download it.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So I'm kind of halfway through filming the second one. And those should be coming out over the next couple of weeks, couple of months, month, something like that.
Great.
So, yeah. Should be good. Man, I think that's a show, dude. Like we covered a lot of ground.
Yeah, that was fun.
Good. It's hang. All too easy. It's so easy for us to talk for hours.
I know. We chatted after the show for a while last time. We should have just kept rolling.
We probably will this time too.
No, man. So, that's my work late night. I got to get back to it.
Oh, that's true. All right. I've got to go eat cookies.
Oh.
Yeah. I'm at home. I'm going to go eat cookies and, I don't know, watch Drive to Survive or something.
Sick.
Yeah.
Sounds like a Friday night, not a Wednesday night.
Well, you got to make every night Friday night if you can. All right, buddy. Well, cool. I hope you have a good week. I hope everyone has a good week. And I'll see you again next week.
Looking forward to it.
All right, everyone. Goodbye. Have a good week.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Spring, is that you? Warmer temps mean new Allbirds styles. Meet the new Superlight Collection, the lightest ever shoes from Allbirds, now in fresh colors. These must-have travel shoes have a lighter-than-air feel and barely-there fit that made them the most packable shoes ever. Plus, they're comfy right out of the box. That means more comfort and less baggage. Experience how Allbirds is redefining comfort. Visit Allbirds.com and use code SUPER24 for a free pair of socks with a purchase of $48 or more. That's ALLBIRDS.com, code SUPER24.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise. Having fun in the sun or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5HETIDE.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5HETIDE.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.